Well, the one, it was exclusive of baseball, was of Muhammad Ali when I came across him. And I wanted just to talk to him about Leon Spinks a little bit. So I see him going through the lobby of the Las Vegas Hilton one time, and he's got a big line of people behind him, of course, and I'm trying to get to the front of the line, and we're going through casinos and, you know, machines and stuff. And finally I get to the elevator and tell him who I am, what I'm doing. He says, "Get on." And he says, "What do you want to know?" I thought, man, this is too easy. So I asked him a few questions, and then he says, "Okay, now I've done you a favor. Can you do one for me?" I thought, oh, brother, what is he talking about here? Mm-hmm. Well, this was the year that he was delivering commencement addresses at Harvard and Oxford. He wanted me to hear what he was going to give to the second group. He polished up the first one, you know, I guess, and I was spellbound.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by Hall of Fame baseball writer, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Can I say institution? Is that a compliment? Institution?
Could be either one.
I think so.
Maybe I should be in one.
Yeah, legend. How about that? Right. St. Louis Post-Dispatch legend, Rick Hummel. Rick, we are recording this podcast in person. It's the first time I've recorded a podcast in person in more than a year. But what a better place. We're actually at the press box named for you and Bob Bragg, which has been here since 2006 when the ballpark opened. And you have come to work in a press box named for you almost every game since for 15 years. Now, 50 years at the newspaper. When you think about how many baseball games you've seen, what keeps you coming back?
A few things. First, that every game is different. Despite the fact that some fans probably think that the Cardinals' recent swoon says, well, I've seen that game before. Well, no, you haven't seen it before. It was a little different, you know, different pitchers. That's a different starting pitcher every day. It's not like you have the same quarterback out there all the time or the same lineup out there all the time. But you see stuff every game almost. You're thinking, well, I haven't seen that before. Like the other night when they're playing Arizona and a guy, they're losing by two runs in a late inning. And there's a guy at second base. And the batter bunts for sacrifice to move him to third. But why? You're still two runs behind.
Yeah.
you know, there are things that make you scratch your head sometimes, and then there are plays like Arenado can make a play. You'll think, well, I haven't seen that one before, you know, where he runs halfway in the left field and then catches the ball that's back to the infield, chest high. I mean, you know, basket catch, slides. Misses an on-rushing left fielder who can run into a wall and break it in O'Neill. Something different every time.
Have you enjoyed telling the stories of games as much as the stories of people? I know how much you adore the game of baseball, and maybe that's a place to start. Has your fondness for the game of baseball grown the more you've seen it?
Yeah. I've really enjoyed being around you for the last 20-some years because you've got a different perspective on the game than I have a lot of times, and it's a good perspective where I might get bogged down in some sort of old-time minutia, and you'll try to get me up to speed on some of the current trends that baseball operates under.
I'm learning on the fly.
I like to break down a game, I guess. I like writing about people. I've enjoyed all the people I've met, almost all of them anyway. But I like to break down a game and maybe try to answer a fan's question. Well, why the heck they do that? Well, I try to explain to them as best we can without being able to go out in the clubhouse anymore, which is hard.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that, like, you can learn something. Like you said, every game brings something new. One of the things I really like about baseball is you can learn something new about it, because people are always adding layers to it. Like you said, styles of play change, styles of play mesh and become hybrid styles. And I wondered about that. I asked the question very clunky, like you're probably used to me asking, but about, like, who I wanted to ask you who some of the people were early on that you talk to and learn the game from, because going from a young fan going to games, as I know you did growing up in Quincy, Illinois, coming to Cardinal games here, I imagine when you crossed that threshold and started writing about them, your knowledge of the game opened up in the same way that, like, say, you go from high school English to taking a semester of English in college, and your knowledge of literature opens up.
There's one way above all others, and it's Whitey Herzog. Every baseball writer should have gotten a chance to spend 10 years covering his teams. I mean, you learn something, I mean, about the game almost every day. You learn something about people, how to handle people, he handles reporters, how you should handle managers and coaches, and you should handle players. Every day was something else, and you had more time to devote to that because you didn't have as many other functions that journalists have now with the online and videos and podcasts. And I've been spared a lot of the stuff. I don't do very many videos and no podcasts. So you guys have taken care of me. But
he says while he's a guest on a podcast,
I couldn't put it together. Now, and he would explain to you every day. I'd go in there at 3 or 4 o'clock in his office, and he'd be doing his charts from the night before. He kept his own charts. He was his own analytics. Mm-hmm. He had different colored pencils for each pitcher, and the next day's pitcher would keep the chart of the previous night's game, where the balls were hit, what the counts were, whatever, who was up. And he'd like to have somebody to talk to while I was doing that. And you could talk about stuff you didn't get a chance to ask him the night before, or that you thought about and were still unsure about. And he would patiently explain it, and you'd think, well, never thought about that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you could see how he handled people. Like, he would made a point of talking to his extra players every day, the pinch hitters, the reserve infielders, the backup catcher, the relievers who never pitch, asking about how their families were and this and that. He says, I don't have to talk to the stars. I know what I'm going to get from them. I want these guys to be ready. When I call their name, they're going to jump out like they're being, shooted out. Yeah. They're ready. They're fired up. Why did he talk to me today? And he says, I'm doing, how are you doing? And, let's go. And he said, I don't need to talk to the stars. And he did, but he didn't need to. And we went along like this for a number of years. And then there was one thing that particularly I could not understand why he did it. And I waited till the next day to ask. I said, why did you do that? It doesn't make any sense with all the stuff you do before. And he put his thumbs in his belt loops like he usually does when he had something profound to say, and says, sometimes you just got to roll the dice. oh, great. Thanks for the explanation.
How was he at challenging questions? Like, how was covering Whitey at times when they would lose or when something would go awry and you'd have these conversations? How was he? Because we see managers in the Zoom age respond, they're just very differently to challenging questions these days.
Well, he was better when they lost or when they got the snot kicked out of them, He'd say, well, good thing it only counted as one.
He enjoyed elaborating on things. Like he was ball talk before we had a phrase for ball talk.
Yeah. And it wasn't, sometimes here we are 30 to 40 years after he's managed, and the game seems much more complicated than it should be. Mm-hmm. He won. He went to 3 World Series in 5 seasons, 6 seasons actually, and with his team maybe hitting a home run now and again. I mean, Jack Clark was here for 2 of those seasons, but he was hurt both those seasons that they won, and the one they didn't win, he was hurt every year. He had a way of, talk about manufacturing runs. They would, infield hits, stolen base, bunt, sacrifice fly, and then 1-0, game over.
Yeah.
he just broke it down where, he could play. I'd like to see him manage a game against an analytics manager let's say Dave Roberts, for instance. The Dodgers are very analytically inclined, and they've been successful. They got good players, too, by the way, and good pitchers.
Yeah. But I'd like to see
Whitey take on those guys and or Leland take on those guys managing the way they used to in the '80s, and see how that went. You know, using their, I wouldn't say seat of the pants approach, but very well thought out, game planned, all situations covered in their heads, not on some spreadsheet.
Well, on those sheets that you watched him draw, he would use those for shifting, right? I mean, like, there were times when he would use those to guide not only, like, how we pitch this guy, but if he would see trends, that was one of the things that, like, Dave Duncan did. He had sure. those big charts. And, like, you know, there's this notion now that, like, shifting came out of the ether or out of Tampa Bay and arrived with, you know, Joe Maddon to you know, combat David Ortiz. But no, I mean, Lou Boudreau shifted famously. The Cardinals shifted and negated, you know, Ted Williams in a World Series. But that's what he was doing, right? That was part of what he was doing.
That was part of it. You wouldn't have the third baseman playing in right field like Manny Machado does for the Padres. But he would use those things that way. But in those days, more pitchers could throw the ball where they were supposed to make these shifts work.
Mm.
Like, for instance, the other night, Alex Reyes is pitching, and he's an excellent reliever, but I don't know that he's used to having shifts performed behind him. Like, he threw one he thought was a ground ball to shortstop, and the shortstop was playing behind the bag, and it was a base hit, yeah. And it went into the outfield. You know, he said, well, I didn't know that.
And the run didn't score, no. Which is another something that we would, with a pinch runner who was put in there for his speed.
Who was standing right next to where the ball was.
Yeah, he didn't seem to think there was a shift either.
No, he said, where's the shortstop? I better go back. He's somewhere. I know he's somewhere.
Are there truisms of baseball that after, you know, being at the paper for 50 years and most of that covering baseball, are there things that you saw in your first game or in that first week that still you see true today, or has the game changed that much? I mean, I would imagine it's throw strikes and be efficient.
Yeah, you would never see as many walks now as you saw then. I mean, you could see there were certain players that could coax walks, but that was on the players a lot of times. Sometimes the pitchers weren't all that wild. The batters just outfoxed them at a particular mm-hmm. at-bat. It wasn't like there's a couple of balls going to the backstop during those at-bats, because those guys wouldn't be in the big leagues. You had to throw strikes to be in the big leagues.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the biggest thing. And you weren't in the big leagues until you were supposed to be in the big leagues. You might be in the minor leagues for 3, 4, 5 years as a good prospect, good player, but there's somebody else ahead of you. And I do find that even more than I know managers like to get all their players involved now, but I still think Whitey used more of his bench players more often than managers do today.
Hmm.
Especially Sunday afternoon games on this broiling artificial turf, which they had for his career here. And the players appreciated, the veteran players and the regulars appreciated the day off after a Saturday night game, not have to come out here and play at 115 when it's 110 on the surface. And Whitey would say, you know, these other guys are going to play like the seventh game in the World Series. And they did, man. They came flying out of there.
Your first day with the Post-Dispatch was July 3rd, 50 years ago. And I believe the first story you wrote was a bike race. Is that correct?
There was a bicycle track at Penrose Park in North St. Louis. And I didn't know anything about bicycle racing or a lot of other stuff then. But I found this guy who was competing in the 35 and over division, who was probably pretty close to double that. So I wrote about him. And he was from Kansas City at the time, but going to Milwaukee, as we have done, there's a park named after him with a bicycle course there.
Wow.
And I said, is this the guy that was cycling for years? Yeah, that's the same guy.
Wow. I didn't know that. So that's cool. How did you go? Did you go in newspapers chasing the chance to write about baseball?
No. I wanted to be a sportscaster as a kid, but was talked out of it because of the fact that not many non-player/athletes, former players, athletes, would have a chance to do that. And that was right, of course. So I was informed I should probably go into writing. But at the time, I didn't know how to type, which was one of the problems, maybe. But my mother typed my stories for me the first year I wrote for the college paper, and then I learned how to type after that. But figured that maybe she couldn't make all the games as I was going to go along here. And
they wouldn't put her on the expenses.
She didn't have a seat in the box, you know. So
it would have been really interesting to introduce live blogging to your mom and to you.
So I just wanted to write about sports, I think, and I didn't know about baseball till I hit a year and a half or two about less than 2 years. I got to cover my first game, and I covered more games. I do 6, 8, 10 one year, then maybe 20 the next year, then maybe 30, maybe 40. I didn't do much traveling until 77, and then I was asked to take over the beat in 78. And I said, let me do it for the rest of the season. It was like May, and I said, let me I'll let you know how I like it. Well, I liked it fine. So I said, yeah, I'd like to keep doing it. And then, but I did not aspire to covering baseball, and at first was kind of intimidating because these are the guys that you read about, mm-hmm. watched on a little bit on TV when games were, you know, there weren't many games on TV then, but there were some. And there were, most people had TVs, by the way, too.
Most people had newspapers on their
some
porch.
Were black and white, but so I didn't really aspire to do that. And then people like Bob Bregg, whom you mentioned earlier, and told me that, you know, they didn't say these guys put their pants legs on one at a time, but that's what they meant when they mm-hmm. said, you just go in there and act like you belong here, you know, and you do belong here. Just ask questions and treat them like men, and they'll treat you the same. And as years go along, and you've seen this, you can write something that will be infuriating or at least annoying to a player. But as long as you're there the next day or the next physical opportunity to have him see you, you could almost, when you were in the clubhouse again, which we aren't now, you could look over in the corner and see him going, he's looking at you like with that fish eye and you're thinking, well, I didn't like it, but he is here, so okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was the end of it.
It's changed a little bit, not just with the access being cut off from the clubhouse for the time being and because of COVID and protocols and the continuation of some of those, but I've been interested how lately it seems like people let frustrations fester a little bit. It used to be you'd go in there and you'd get it over with, right? If they were frustrated with you, Tony was frustrated with you, you were going to hear it the next day or soon after. Many, many players from that generation, you know, if Scott Rowland was frustrated or some of those players, Reggie Sanders, if those guys had an issue with something you wrote, you were likely going to hear about it the next day. Man, some of these, some recently, they sit for months, you know, they don't address it, and it gets worse before it gets better. But that's partially because, like, the dynamics have changed too, with, you know, limited access, less conversational access, probably.
Social media will tell them
exactly
what they think was written,
right?
Yeah. Whether the player had read it or not.
That's right. Or like family will like relay, well, this is what was said, and so they're. That is when it gets really interesting, is when what was written is relayed completely different. It becomes a game of telephone. And I had an example of that where something like that happened, and it was probably 30 days of it sitting there and, you know, player not talking to me.
I guess you're right about that. I mean, in those days, there wasn't any social media. There was no internet. There was no, well, a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
and the newspapers were more, you know, a proliferation of newspapers. Every city had at least two, even us, you know. And most had three, four. And that's how people got their information mostly. We didn't have talk radio and stuff like that, except for Cam Wex maybe here. Yeah.
How did you end up writing your first Cardinals game story? How did you get that assignment?
I think I was home. I lived in Belleville then. I think I lived in North County then, actually. And Neil Russo, who was one of the beat guys, had some issue where he couldn't make it to the park. So I got a call about, I don't know, 4 o'clock.
Wow.
Could I get down to the ballpark? So I dashed down there, and I didn't know anything about how to get into it. So I went in the regular way like the fans do. And I walked down the steps to the box seat railing, and I hopped over it onto the field. And the Expos were in town. And Gene Mock was standing there, the veteran, very successful, legendary manager, but crusty manager. And he's standing there, and he surely must be thinking, well, who is this Yahoo?
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
But I hopped over. I'd seen one guy that I remembered as a Cardinal. It was Boots Day. He was playing for the Expos then. So I thought I was going to go over and talk to Boots Day and tell him who I was. And I remember seeing him play for the Cardinals. But Gene Mock intercepted me and, like, who are you? And what are you doing here?
Did you have a credential?
I had a credential. I guess he could tell that I sort of belonged there, technically belonged there, yeah. But not really.
That's amazing.
How long before you were confident using a word like Swatsman in a game story? Or Extrogen?
It seems... I think pretty early on, maybe, because we were an afternoon paper for 13 years after I've been here. And so you had plenty of time to concoct some of these things, you know, overnight. No, too much time to think.
You could let the words marinate a bit.
They don't come spilling out necessarily the same way as they do.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask how you're a different writer, but I wanted to ask first, how much were you influenced by Bob and how he wrote about baseball?
Well, he was different. Was. I don't think the. He was a great grammarian, but many, many long sentences that meandered here and there. You know, there were certain items he wanted to get into sentence, and he there was just a different style of writing then. A lot of guys wrote like that, I guess, when he was starting out. But he was very thorough. He knew the game, He had a little temper. If he didn't like what was going on, he didn't mind letting them know. But he taught me a lot just about being a man, just going in there and doing what I'm supposed to do, and not worry about what these ball cards look like or from these players or how famous they might be. They just talk to them.
That was a great piece of advice that the late Joe Strauss gave me pretty early on when I had somewhat. Earn my stripes with him, so you know, about 10 years in. No, he told me I was trying to get a description, or I was trying to get an answer about what had happened on the field, and he knew I was frustrated because you get these runaround answers and everything like that. And he said, just write what you saw and write what you know is true, and you don't need them to say. You don't need Tony to admit it. You don't need the player to admit it. You don't need that. Just write what you see. And he goes, you're the expert now. He said, you saw what you saw and you know what you saw. Write it. That was such a, it was such a way to, it was great. It was so, freeing because it was like, I don't have to, you know, chase after an explanation to then refute. I just can write it.
That's what, you were familiar with Joe Pollack, the great theater critic,
yeah.
and food critic, and former sports writer. So it isn't like he didn't cover this stuff.
And baseball writer, critic, as yeah. I felt the skewer yeah. of.
Oh, well, I didn't know about that. Anyway, he said one point to me, he says, I don't have to go down and talk to the actors after a performance at the Muni or something like that. I just write what you saw, just what you described there. And he's right. If you've seen enough games, there are things I don't know about that have happened, or I have a mistaken interpretation of it. Not as many as when I started out,
mm-hmm.
and it's because I've watched and cataloged a lot of the stuff I've seen over the years, and understand why things were done. And right, you don't have to have somebody backstop you with a quote. You know, might even be one you wouldn't even use ordinarily.
Right,
you're just trying to break it up a little bit, so that. He's right, and Joe was right to tell you the same thing.
How have you changed as a writer, you think, through the years? Besides typing for yourself.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think one of the things I've tried not to change, let me back up a little bit. One of the things I've tried not to change is to make sure that as best I can that the the readers are informed and entertained. And I don't like to preach to the readers very much. I consider them to be, if they've taken the time to read this, then they want to learn about something. They don't need to be scolded, you mm-hmm. know, if they don't think the same way I do, or I have to make them think the way I do, you know, that somebody should make them the way that they think. And so as far as have I changed, I think there's always the running battle with putting together a storyline format in your head when you have about a half hour to go before mm-hmm. deadline. And I still need to be better at that, as far as what goes first, second, third, fourth, sixth, and I know where it all, I know I want it all to get in, but where does it go? And you don't have much time to draw a graph here. You know, you just got to go.
Right.
And
yeah.
So I think that part is changed, where I got to be a little bit more organized, shall I say, and make sure that the best stuff is where it should be.
I have the sense that if we do this 50 years from now, you might say the same thing. Like, it's like always that kind of feel like, oh, I could do that a little better. I think about that too. Like I could make that, I could put that puzzle pieces together differently and make it look a little better.
Well, the different part about newspapers is now that they want to have X amount of stories on the front page, and you might only have 3 to 4 to 6 inches of your story out of a 25 to 30 inch story on page yeah. one, and you really don't know how many people are going to go to page 5 to run down the rest of it. You know, they might just, they're just kind of flitting around.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't want to put stuff on in your 18th paragraph that you can get into the 5th paragraph and get it on page 1, where they'll think, oh wow, that's interesting. Then I'll go read
yeah.
it. Yeah,
that's a great point. Yeah, I sometimes put stuff in 18 just to reward somebody who got there. Or maybe just to reward myself for writing 18.
In the day, you'd have maybe three stories, you know, with a lot of pictures on the front page, but long stories. You'd have to spread yeah. across the page. It was more of a horizontal thing now. Now there's a lot of vertical involved, and that's just the way newspapering has changed too.
So here's something that I've not asked you all these years. When you go to an event, the late Pete Finney, who a longtime columnist in New Orleans, he told me to forever cherish a championship on your beat. He said, not because like you're a fan, but because it's a chance to rise to the occasion of that team. Like, because that those stories you write are going to be read. Those stories that you write are going to be kept and clipped and saved. And so, you know, always cherish it, but it's your chance to rise to the occasion, because you don't want that to be the day that you have a typo that everybody clips and keeps forever, or that you know, swing and miss. When you've written so many of the historic moments that people and fans from the 80s and 90s clipped and saved, when you were on the brink of something like that, like going to the 82 World Series when you know that one of the teams was going to be a champ, or going to 87, did you spend the day thinking about how you might write it? Did you workshop things, or did you let it just arrive on deadline?
A little of both. I think knowing that there was going to be a deadline involved, you had to have a win-lose aspect of both these things. But, and I don't say I want you would wing it other than that, but I didn't try to treat it too much differently than another game. Although the thoughts you've just brought up, you think about, but I thought if I spent too much time thinking about it, I would just get nervous and wrap myself into a ball. I didn't want to be like that. I just wanted to let it flow. But you do have to have a preparation for it. You have to assume that it's going to rain every game, and
you do. Yeah, that is a great piece of advice. Always count on a rain out. Always have something in your back pocket. Yeah,
yeah.
So, otherwise, I didn't try to treat those things any differently. Even though, yes, you'll see more people. You knew that all your colleagues were watching, and now with the internet, the whole world is watching what you have to write. You know, I mean, that's one of the biggest differences, by the way. I branch off, is that many years ago, somebody would say something to you that would be, you know, controversial, and often it would never get out of St. Louis. The wire services either did or did not pick it up, but they didn't understand as the years went along. Well, I just told you that. I said, well, yeah, but this is the way it goes. That's going to go from me to some. I didn't tell anybody, but they're going to find out. Okay.
Yeah. Did you find that conversations with fans have changed by social media? I mean, like, when you're covering the team, would people walk up and quiz you, like have barstool conversations with you if you got in a taxi? Would someone know who you were?
Gradually, yes.
Yeah.
And I always thought if they've taken the time to ask pertinent questions, that you should take the time to give them pertinent answers as far as you know. Sometimes you have to say, I don't know. And I hate to do that, but I'd rather not make up anything. I just say, I don't know.
Did it feel like you had hundreds and thousands of editors?
Yes. Now we have about two, because that's just the way I think, you know, that the papers are now. I mean, you're your own editor now. You better be a good one, too.
Yeah, no kidding.
Some of the best games don't always make for the best stories, though they usually do. What were some of your favorite games to cover that you – I mean, does Game 6 of 2011 World Series, does that stand out as one that you really enjoyed covering, or something from '82 or the Ryan Sandberg / Willie McGee game?
That would be one of them, that last one you mentioned. In 2011, I was part of the chorus then. I wasn't doing the game story. You know, I was doing a sidebar or at-large piece or something. So I wasn't as invested in the game from start to finish as I would have been otherwise. I think I was one of the scorers even, you know. Or maybe I wasn't. But anyway, still, I wasn't like planning from the first inning on what I was going to write. So sometimes I didn't know until the game was over what I was going to write. The Willie McGee Sandberg game was one of the classics. I thought the 1 year I've always thought were the best games I've seen in back-to-back weeks or 10-day periods were the '86 Championship Series in the National League and the World Series, which the Mets won both. The championship series, they were down 3-2 to Houston, up 3-2 to Houston, in Houston for Game 6 and 7. And Game 7 was going to be pitched by Mike Scott, who was accused, probably correctly, of scuffing the baseball with sandpaper or whatever he would like to use. And he'd shot out the Mets early in the series. And the Mets were deathly afraid that same thing would happen again. And in those days, they rotated the umpires a little differently. If you did home plate the first game, you did Game 7 at home plate. And Doug Harvey was the umpire. And the Mets must have asked for 20 balls that first game. And Harvey would look at it, and he'd say, it looks pretty good to me, and throw it right back to Scott. Never been throwing it out of the game. And so the Mets, fast forward, got down 3-0 in the ninth inning of Game 6 against Bob Nepper, tied it up. And then went, I think, 17 innings or something, ended up winning by a run to get to the series. Now we go to the series, and Boston's got them beaten. And, you know, the Red Sox collapsed in the extra innings. And, yeah, the ball went through Buckner's legs at the end, but the game was already tied. You know, they've been a wild pitch to score the tying run. So if Buckner even makes the play, the Red Sox might still lose. But those games, while exciting games, the second one ended about 1:00 New York time. That is not real good on a Saturday night for newspaper people. that is a real bad time for local newspaper people, because it's midnight here, and your story is written. You got one team that's 2 runs ahead, and now they're 1 run behind all of a sudden in a space of about 10 minutes. So those two games in that 1 year stand out more than any other, probably because they were both excruciatingly tense games, and luckily one was in the afternoon, the first one at Houston, and then the second one, unluckily, was at night.
And what stood out about writing about those games? What makes them memorable from, like, well, besides the horrendous deadline?
Well, just of how fast you had to shift, you know. You sit there and you give yourself maybe 15 or 20 seconds to think about what you're going to do. I mean, if you have that long to think about it. you just kind of hope, you pray to God that he puts you in the right direction, you know, and so you can get going. Because once you, I've always found once you get started, you're all right. You just got to get started, and then you let it rip. But the timing was just, people were, you know, in the old days, if you watched the movies and stuff, they'd be ripping this out of your Underwood typewriter and throwing it across the room and putting a new paper and cranking it up and swearing.
And shouting out, rewrite, yeah, rewrite. Yeah.
What's an interview that stands out that you've had? Maybe it's ongoing, but what's an interview that you've had that stood out through the years?
Well, the one, it was exclusive of baseball, was of Muhammad Ali when I came across him. This goes back to my boxing coverage days in the 70s, and Leon Spinks from St. Louis was fighting a fight where the winner was going to fight Ali for the championship, world championship in 78 in Las Vegas. This was 77, like November, I think, the fight that Spinks was at. Ali was going to be there. And I wanted just to talk to him about Leon Spinks a little bit. So I see him going through the lobby of the Las Vegas Hilton one time, and he's got a big line of people behind him, of course, and I'm trying to get to the front of the line, and we're going through casinos and, you know, machines and stuff, and finally I get to the elevator and tell him who I am, what I'm doing. He says, get on. So we all get on the elevator, keep going up, and of course Ali is at the last one left, heading for the penthouse at some point. Mm-hmm. I'm still on there with him. He says, okay, let's get out here. And he opens the door to the penthouse, and he tells his wife, who was Veronica Portion, a lovely lady, said she can go down to the whatever she's doing, and he's in good hands here. And and he says, what do you want to know? I thought, man, this is too easy. So I asked him a few questions. And then he says, okay, I've done you a favor. Can you do one for me? I thought, oh, brother, what is he talking about here? Mm-hmm. Well, this was the year that he was delivering commencement addresses at Harvard and Oxford. And I don't know which one was first. He'd already done one, and he had one more to do. And he wanted me to hear what he was going to give to the second group. He had pretty polished up the first one, you know, I guess. So I thought, sure. And I don't know, I can't tell you what he talked about other than the fact it was not about boxing and it wasn't about anything you would think he was going to talk about. It was about leadership and a little bit about politics and about being a good person. And I was spellbound.
Wow.
And it was like the whole process took 45 minutes to an hour. And I said, you know, I don't have anything to add there. I think it's great. I really did. And we shook hands, and that was the first and last time we talked. But I was, that's 44 years ago. And I'll never forget that.
What a moment!
And I don't think that many writers had the opportunity. And it was just one of those luck of the draws where he had some time, and he had an audience, and he. The first topic I brought up to him seemed to be of some interest. And, of course, as we later find out, Spinks wins the fight, first fight, and then loses the second one. But I will always treasure that interview, and nothing even comes close to that.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably hard for baseball to rise to that level. I mean, you've obviously talked to, like, Hank Aaron. That would be,
I have interviewed him, but not at tremendous length. I mean, he knew who I was and where I was from. I'm trying to think about the baseball aspect of that. Maybe, I mean, there's so many interviews you do here with the Cardinals that some last a long time and some don't.
Yeah.
I mean, Ted Simmons was always one of my favorite guys to interview because he was very thoughtful about a lot of things, too, and adamant about some things. I guess that my favorite interview was with him. When he was playing first base one night and didn't have a good night over there. He was not a good first baseman. He was a catcher. But for some reason, Red put him over there one night, Red Chaney, and he made a couple of errors and got booed. And after the game, he's talking, and then now he's going on a rant about it. Well, I didn't ask to play here, and blah, 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 and the fans are lousy, and they've been your worst fans, and, you know, whatever. And we're an afternoon paper then, and I hadn't written too much baseball at that point, so I'm thinking, well, I got kind of a hot story here, but I don't know what. I went back to the office and thought about it a little bit, and I thought, I'm going to tell my editors what I have here. I don't I don't know him that well yet to go ahead and run this. I don't know if he meant all of it. So I did a – you wouldn't do that now. You'd just go ahead and run it. But I did a printout of the story and took it over to him the next night. Now it's a Friday night. It would run in the Sunday paper if I didn't run the story rather than the Friday paper. And he had criticized the fans, and he was from Detroit. Detroit was a big, good sports town since in the 70s. And it's about 5 pages long, and he goes through it, one page after the other, hands it back to me and says, "Have a party." So I did. And he got just roasted. You know, once he said St. Louis was a bad sports town, that was – and he had to, you know – double back from that, certainly, but he never said it because he didn't, and I gave him 2 shots at it, and I was glad that I did it, but I wouldn't do it that way again, even though I didn't know him that well at the time.
Yeah, and now he's going to join you in the halls of fame. He'll be there. I mean, what does that mean to you to see the arc, not just of his career, but and also, you know, the arc of the perception of his career, and then the quest to Cooperstown that has really, I mean, it's been something that you've covered now for more than half of your time with the Post-Dispatch.
Just about 20-some years. And I was one of his, I guess, few champions for a while on these veterans committees that I've served on. Otherwise, he'd have been in by now. So there weren't very many others, but I was loquacious enough and convincing enough to keep getting him on the ballot every year. And this would come around every 2, 3, 4 years, depending on how they would do the committees. and I would call him every 2 or 3 years about this and say, "Well, I feel this is the year." He said, "Who's on the voting committee?" And I'd give him the names. And if they were mostly American League, people would say, "I haven't got a chance," because Ted barely played in the American League. Played a couple years with the Brewers as well, and when they were in the American League. And so finally when he got – and he talked himself into that he wasn't going to get in. Mm-hmm. And then he finally did. And now he's celebrating every moment. And even though he's had to wait a whole year for his induction per se, and it looked like it was only going to be for family and friends, now a few people are going to be allowed. He said, "I don't care what they do. As long as they don't throw me out, I'm going to do whatever they tell me to do. You know, I'm in." And it will be, you know, a culmination more for him, but a little bit for me, because I fought behind the scenes for this to happen. And in my small way, I helped.
Yeah. I was thinking about that the other day, that the story of Ted Simmons' career overlaps with your career of writing stories. Like that's almost like the entire, you know, the arc of the whole thing, like from the beginning to the end, everything in between, him being a scout, a manager, you know, him coming around here and talking. It's interesting just to have somebody so present for the entirety of your career that, you know, you'll be linked because you wrote so many of the words that then now some of them are inevitably going to be pulled from your stories and put in bronze.
Hmm. I hadn't thought about that, but he'd be the one guy who would stay late after every game to talk to you if you had a question. Mm. They had these metal lockers, and he would sit there with nothing on. His bare butt would be on that metal locker floor, and it had to be cold, and he'd be smoking a cigarette and just kind of gazing off into space. but he had time for you.
Yeah.
And often, you know, he would say things like, there was a pitcher that was talking to Ted one day, and the pitcher came by, and he was okay, but he had some rough times, and I wrote that he had some rough times, and he started getting on me, and and they went away, and Ted said, "Don't worry about that. He's an idiot."
I have this pet theory, I guess is a way to describe it. Pet theory that right now, the athletes in the game have never been better. That there are more athletes and more talent in baseball than ever. And the game is different because of the factors influencing the game that we've seen, you know, analytics take over in such a way that now it's a risk management game as opposed to what you described earlier with Whitey Herzog, you know, sometimes, you know, instincts and emotion. And, you know, instead of saying this is the right time to try to steal, now it's run through a computer that, well, 70% of the time this is the right time to steal. You know, or how are you adding to your win probability? You know, this kind of stacking on. But I still think like that the talent, the ability and athleticism we see on the field, plays like Nolan Arenado makes, or Mike Trout, or, you know, Fernando Tatis Jr., some of the things that we see, or the 100-mile-an-hour pitches with movement, have never been better. Am I off base? No pun intended?
No, bigger, stronger, faster, no question. Better athletes. Now, are they better players?
Right.
That's to be debated.
Interesting. Well, because the fundamentals have kind of been softened because the talent is so great.
I mean, there's raw skills incomparable from one area to the next. But were they better players? Which team would win more games if with that type of mentality playing for them on old time or new time? If you had, you know, some talent, you know, some skills on the older players, but.
I mean, the comparison would be like you take the hot shot, hard throwing rookie. And how would he do opposite Adam Wainwright, a pitch maker? That's essentially what you're describing.
Sure, and, I'd like to think that Ted Simmons and Henry Aaron and Willie Mays and those guys would be pretty darn good players today, too. Even though a couple of them are 80 years old and some of them are not with us anymore. But like Musial used to say, when, you know, he'd be 75 or 80, and they'd ask him, "Well, Stan, how would you do today if you played?" I'd hit about 275, and 275. I'm 75 years old.
So, in that vein, I'd be remiss not to ask you about the current Cardinals. Are they, in some ways, I mean, they're a product of the modern game in the sense that, you know, they talk about their modern hitting approach, and, you know, that's had some, you know, well, it's been wobbly as they go. And then they have all this infusion of young players who are just learning to, you know, pitch. And they're doing so at the big league level as opposed to in the 1,200 innings or whatever it was that they would get in the minors. When you look at the current Cardinal team, do you think some aspects of the modern game is why they've been so inconsistent?
Sure. I mean, there's two or three guys that wouldn't be playing on a team a number of years ago because they didn't have the experience to deal with all the things they're going to come up against. They just had they could just throw 95 or 98 with a good slider. They could strike you out, but could they get you out? Doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah. What does this team need? What do they need to do? Can they just play better and be better? It's nice of the division to wait for them.
Except for Milwaukee's winning for nobody.
All right, fair. Fair. Yeah.
They need to get starting like Carlos gave them, and then, you know, Kim needs to give them. And LeBlanc is kind of a filler, but he did okay. And you're going to have to see Oviedo do better, too. And Wainwright, it's a lot of pressure to heap on him to expect him to be really good every game because he's 39 years old. He wasn't really good every game when he was 30. He was really good, but not every game. So they just have to hold on. And it looks like, you know, we're talking maybe into August for Flaherty and Michaelis and maybe even Hicks to come back. Well, that's a long way. That's a bunch of ball games, and a bunch of them are against the Giants and Cubs right off the bat here once they get done with these Rockies this weekend. They've got 13 in a row with the Giants and Cubs, and those games could dictate very much where the Cardinals are going to be, sellers or buyers, when we get to the end of the month here. If the Cubs and Giants make mincemeat of them, there's the word, mincemeat, then it's time to sell.
What's it like to cover a seller? I've been here for 18 years. This is, my 18th season. And your years of experience I'll have to pull from that quite a bit to know what it's like to cover a seller.
Well, a couple of times they were tried to be sellers, they end up getting into the playoff. In like 2001, they traded Ray Lankford for Woody Williams to San Diego, They were like 9.5 games back, and it was August the 2nd. They weren't going anywhere. And suddenly they're in the playoffs.
Yeah. No, well, yeah, I guess Stranger
Randy Williams won about 8-1 when he figured out here, and everybody started playing better. And even in 2011, they weren't that good when they had those trades that they got rid of Rasmus and brought in Edmund Jackson and Dotel and Zibchinski and some guys, some good pitchers to flesh out a bullpen, but they weren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
They were a 500 team, and then there they were, the world champions.
Did you ever think that a lineup, as much as we've talked about this lineup and its need to add somebody over the last few years, that a lineup that had Goldschmidt and Arenado would struggle offensively?
Not as much. And Arenado has been, I would say, good. He has not been great offensively because he's in his 260s, you know, but he's hit 16 home runs and he's got 50-some RBIs. Goldschmidt has not been great. He's been better lately, but he will have to be better for this to work. And I know we're seeing him on the downslide. I don't want to use slide. The down cycle of a great career. We're not getting the same player. The fans are not getting the same player that he had was in Arizona. He's 30-some years old. He's a good player now who can be a very good player. Arenado is still potentially a great player in the field, and he's been a very good offensive player, but can be better too. So, yeah, they got to be – these are the guys who are going to have to carry the mail. They know that.
Do you like that aspect of our side of the fence where, like you said, the downturn of a career? I mean, there are players who know that their best game is behind them. But if you cover baseball, you could always say your best story is still ahead, right?
You could say that, but would your best stories be – could you do them 10, 12, 14, 15 days in a row at a later age? You probably couldn't. You might have – I might have one or two really good ones in me at a certain point, but could I reel off a succession of 15 or 20? I don't think I could.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it. That is the other aspect. You do have to. There's no 0-for-4 with 4 Ks, and you get to come back tomorrow. That's right. Usually the end of writing.
Yeah, or you know, you don't get a day off. You're back in the lineup the next day, whether you want to or not.
Right. As they look for somebody else, they do need somebody to do the job.
I had a bad day. You better get somebody else. No, you're back out there tomorrow.
All right. Last thing I want to ask you. So you've had interviews turned down. I mean, you know, Bob Gibson wasn't always eager to talk and probably had no comment a few times. Did you ever pull out the Muhammad Ali card? Did you ever say, hey, look, I talked to the champ. You can spend 5 minutes talking to me.
I did not. Now you're telling me this. Don't be afraid, you know, 15, 20 years ago to run that out.
Oh, sorry.
No, I did not do that, nor did I even think of doing it. And Bob Gibson, by the way, never turned me down.
Oh, okay. I got it wrong.
Well, I'd say once. I mean, he wasn't feeling well at the time. But and I've had some great interviews with him. Oh, that's one we should add to the list there, if I might. I know it's I'll try to convince us into a minute here. But the year he went in the Hall of Fame, 1981, I went out to Omaha to do a story on him. He picked me up at – he met me at his restaurant downtown. I flew into Omaha. We talked there for a while, went home, talked at his house. He had a new house. He's building a new deck. Asked me to stay for dinner. I said, okay. And I forgot I had to do a radio show, and it took an hour. And he said, okay, we'll wait for you. And so we did that, interviewed some more, went back downtown to his bar restaurant. Now it's 9 o'clock, and we're leaving, maybe 9:30, 10 o'clock. And he says, Wendy, to his wife, Wendy, can you believe I've talked to a sports writer for 9 hours? And that's that.
No one will talk to me for 9 hours. Except for you. You're stuck, though. Captive audience. You can find all of Rick Hummel's coverage at stltoday.com. He's got the games of Arizona as I head out on the road to Colorado, San Francisco, and Chicago. And then we will reunite at the All-Star Game. It will be how many All-Star Games for you?
This will be the 41st in succession.
41 consecutive.
Since 1980, and they didn't play in 94.
So. Right, yeah. And last year.
Well, that would be maybe that's 40 then. Let me think. 80? 2,042. It would be 40, I guess, yeah.
So 40. Magic 40. There, mile high.
They did play 94. Not just not last year.
Right,
so it's
right,
41.
Right. Okay, 41. Yeah. So 41 at 5,000 feet above sea level at Coors Field. It'll be good. I get to host you for your 41st All-Star game a little bit.
I remember the first one being out there, and it was 1998.
Yeah.
And Leland was the manager of the world champion Florida Marlins then. And they were awful because they unloaded everybody. So that was the last, you know, big game that he managed in his life for a long time until he got back with Detroit. Then he managed the Rockies the next year after that, I think.
Here's a piece of trivia that the Times-Picayune asked me once if I would draw sports cartoons for them. And I said, sure, if you send me to the Major League Baseball All-Star game every year. That was it. I'll draw cartoons. I'll do whatever, a Sunday cartoon, whatever. I just want to go cover the All-Star game every year. Because I mean, you're not going to give me another salary for drawing a cartoon. I have to do that in addition to the writing and everything. And then part of it was, like, I think I could get to Coors Field for the All-Star game. And then Atlanta, I think, was one of them in there. But they declined. So I never did. I never did draw the cartoons for them. I was, like, bartering.
Well, now you can do it for the Post-Dispatch.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't have brought this up.
Well,
the best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Get organized with Closet by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closet by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. You can find the best podcast in baseball at stltoday.com, along with all the Constant Cardinals coverage from Hall of Fame writer Rick Hummel as he begins year 51 here shortly. With a trip to Denver to cover the All-Star game and all the other stuff we have going on, including chats galore. Dave Matter and Ben Fredrickson have their videos on Mizzou. There's Ten Hockman every day, a video at 10 o'clock in the morning at stltoday.com. And of course, we appreciate the subscribers to the paper. It's still cool to see your byline in print, Rick. It really is. I look forward to that.
I do, too. Thank you.
Yeah, I do. That brings me to the last question. So the Cardinals will be off in San Francisco. That means it's time for the annual tweet, right? Even though Matt Cain's not around, do you have the annual tweet at Commish Hummel planned?
Well, that's a good question. I may have to get him involved. Maybe I will tweet on July 3rd, that this is actually my 50th official anniversary. And there's two ahead of their series in Colorado. Maybe I can work that in San Francisco, and they work that in that way.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good. All right, well, look for that.
Matt Cain may or may not care, but this is...
That is Hall of Fame baseball writer, St. Louis Post-Dispatch icon, legend. I'm going with both.
Well, they're both pretty strong.
They're really strong, but you have a press box named after you. Veteran. He has to get back to work in the press box name for him. I have to get to a flight. Thank you all for listening. This has been the best podcast in baseball for Hall of Fame baseball writer Rick Hummel. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you next week from the road from San Francisco.